You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, Wisconsin saw a record number of new COVID-19 cases on May 1st, but does that mean the disease is spreading more or that we're testing more people? A new WisContext report tells us why the daily results are more complicated than they might look. First, it can be hard to know what our purpose in life is, even in normal times. During a pandemic, our daily schedules have shifted, jobs have been altered or lost, and finding meaning in the day-to-day can feel even more difficult. Our next guest has some guidance for us to find and create a purpose for our days, even during these tough times, sometimes just one day at a time. Christine Whelan is a clinical professor in the School of Human Ecology at UW-Madison, where she teaches classes on happiness and well-being, and is also the founding director of the Money, Relationships, and Equality Initiative. She's a speaker and the author of several books, including The Big Picture, A Guide to Finding Your Purpose in Life. Christine, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks. Good to be on.
Talk a little bit, if you will, about this concept of finding purpose. It sounds simple in some ways and really big and complicated and overwhelming in others.
Yeah, so some people define purpose as your singular life aim. And especially in a pandemic, that kind of gives me heart palpitations. So instead, I think that we should all kind of break it down into a more day-to-day kind of approach. And I say that that's looking at life with a purpose mindset. And so to do that, I encourage people to ask themselves a couple of questions. And again, all these questions are just on a day-by-day basis. First of all, what are the values that you want to use today? What are the values that you want to guide you? Second, what are the gifts and talents and strengths that you want to use to just today in your day-to-day life? And who are the groups or types of people or individuals that you want to positively impact? And if you put those together, you've kind of got the beginnings of a purpose statement. If you put it together, you can put it together because I value, and then you insert your values. I will use my gifts for, and then you insert your gifts, to positively impact the lives of, and then you say who you want to make a difference in the lives of just today. It's a first step toward helping people figure things out on a day-by-day basis.
You have a worksheet to help people do that. We've got that linked on our website, wpr.org/centraltime. Can you give us some four examples? What kind of shape might that take as we insert those gifts and purposes in there?
Yeah, so, you know, everyone can do it really themselves. So a value, you know, happiness is not a value. It's a byproduct of living your values. So you might value commitment or sustainability or family. And then if you think about the things that you're good at, I like to think about it in terms of want-to skills, things you want to do, not things you can do or have to do. And then in terms of the people you want to impact or the groups you want to impact, you know, that can change day by day, but you can think small or think big. But the other element that I've put on this worksheet and is important all the time, but especially in these tough times right now, is to acknowledge our fears and anxieties that might hold us back from living purposefully and to really name those. You could say, gosh, you know, I'm fearing for my health. I'm fearing that I'm not being helpful enough or that I'm failing at my job while I'm trying to balance my family responsibilities as well. And then with that in mind, you can still make purpose-based commitments to do something meaningful on an even small level. It might even be like creating a taco bar night with your family or going for a walk. The idea is to make conscious choices in keeping with your values so that we have that good feeling that we're using our time in a way that matters most to us.
Well, I love this, and you could talk about why this is important, because I haven't tried it myself, it sounds manageable and bite-sized and something we could actually take action on day by day.
Yeah, so amazingly enough, the research finds time and again that if you take a daunting task and break it down into small steps, it can feel a lot more manageable and, in fact, even like a pleasurable exploration of possibilities. And so by creating what I often call like a Mad Libs purpose statement, fill-in-the-blanks exercise, then you can do this on a day-to-day basis. It would only take just a couple minutes. You can do it on your own. You can do it with your family at breakfast or at dinner for the next day. And it's a way to kind of ground yourself, but also create, instead of like a to-do list that, I don't know, often judges us for whether we're getting our things done, but instead this is creating a sort of a who I am and what I care about mantra that can be really empowering through the day.
We're talking to Christine Whelan from the School of Human Ecology at UW-Madison, author of the book The Big Picture, A Guide to Finding Your Purpose in Life. She's sharing advice on finding our purpose one day at a time during the pandemic. We've got a link to that worksheet she was talking about at WPR.org/Central Time. Christine, I got to admit, I'm kind of a muddle through, you know, without really thinking about it kind of guy. What do we get out of thinking about purpose and defining it and acting on it?
Purpose is often described as the why behind everything we do. And all too often, we think about goals, right? We think about the things that we want to do. But a goal is really a step on the path to a larger why, right? So if you just are kind of kicking off the days, you can kind of feel like a dead person walking. You know, you're just doing all the things that you have to do and none of the things you want to do. So thinking about really what matters to you is a great way to do kind of a check of, am I spending my time in a way that matters? Am I using these resources, whether it be money or time, in keeping with what matters most to me? And oftentimes we will say, gosh, no, you know, I'm not. And then you can do one of two things. You can say, listen, I need to change my behavior so it will fit in terms of these things that I really do believe. Or you can say, you know what, maybe I say that that's what I believe, but honestly, if you think about how I'm living my life, maybe I need to give myself a little more credit for actually caring about some other things more. And that's okay too. I find it's a way of kind of not beating myself up so much and getting honest and really feeling positive about the things that I do.
And the not beating ourselves up too much reminds me, you did an online presentation on this topic, Christine, and you started by speaking to a bunch of groups of people who maybe you say don't have to put all this thought into their purpose right now because they're living it and not having much choice in the matter.
All over my social media feed, the self-help gurus are telling me that if I am not using this national slowdown as a time to find, you know, how to be a better me, that I'm wasting my time somehow. And I got to tell you, just back off, people, right? I mean, there are so many people who are out there who are essential workers. How about the parents of young children who are juggling their own jobs and trying to homeschool their kids? And how about everybody who is in a state of uncertainty and a little bit of panic at various different times in all of this? We need to be kind to ourselves and take it day by day, step by step. And that's really why I created this day at a time pandemic purpose exercise. It wasn't to give people another thing to worry about, but rather to make people really feel good about all of the wonderful things that we are all doing on a day-to-day basis and realizing how meaningful they are.
Now, the book I mentioned earlier, The Big Picture, that you wrote, you really focused it toward younger adults. And that can be a time in normal times where people are trying to figure out who they are, what they want in life. And now this curveball, the things they thought they could count on with the college classes, the first job, whatever it might be, that's even up in the air right now. What would you say to them in particular in this time?
So young adults who are just starting their career, I mean, this is a time of even more uncertainty than usual. And when you look at a life transition, I say sometimes people are pushed by pain to make a change, and other times people are pulled by possibility. Usually for young people, pulled by the possibility of life, and right now they are being pushed by pain into their next possibility. And so, you know, you take one day at a time, just like everybody else, and asking and answering these questions of purpose is incredibly important, not just for you to know who you are, but as you go out and think about how your skills can be deployed in a whole variety of different job sectors. If you know what your values are, then you can see where a good match would be for a particular company, and you can talk about what matters to you in a way that will hopefully open up lots of job possibilities for you. So I encourage young adults, and in fact all of us who are all in a time of transition, to really think about the why behind what we do, think about what matters most, and then how we can make it happen in our lives.
We'll leave it there. Christine, thanks for sharing this with us today.
Thank you.
Christine Whelan is a clinical professor in the School of Human Ecology at UW-Madison, where she teaches classes on happiness and well-being. She's the founding director of the Money, Relationships, and Equality Initiative. Her books include The Big Picture, A Guide to Finding Your Purpose in Life. You can find her Pandemic Purpose Worksheet that she talked about. It's linked on our website, wpr.org/centraltime. Coming up, COVID-19 numbers come out every day, and it can be hard to keep track of them and what they mean. A new WIS context report tells us why it's important to watch the number of tests being given and why a daily increase in the raw number of positive results may not be as bad as it looks. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the U.S. Senate is back in session this week, but another coronavirus relief package isn't high on the agenda. We'll talk to a congressional reporter about what lawmakers are up to. First, Wisconsin clocked 460 new cases of COVID-19 on May 1st. That's a record number for the state since it began tracking the disease. But the number of new cases confirmed each day isn't the only metric that state officials look at as they decide how and when to relax public health guidelines. They're also looking at how it compares to the number of tests that come back negative. And that could change the picture of the severity of the virus here in Wisconsin. A new report from WisContext sorts out the different numbers and what they mean. Will Cushman is the associate editor of WisContext. His newest piece is What Wisconsin's Shifting COVID-19 Numbers Show as Testing Broadens. You can find that at wiscontext.org. Will, welcome back to the show.
Howdy, Rob. Thanks for having me.
Well, let's look at that number, kind of the one of the big numbers we look at every day when they announce it here in the state. How many new positive COVID-19 tests there are in the state? And when that number goes up, it initially looks like a bad thing. Obviously, more cases is bad, but it's more complicated than that, as you write. Can you tell us why?
Yeah. So you're right. Anytime that there's an increase in numbers, especially if it's a big one or bigger than it's been in the past, can be kind of reason to pause for a second and wonder what's going on. So the number of new cases is that's reported every day is important to keep track of, A, just to know what's going on in the state in terms of the COVID-19 outbreak, but B, because it can help us understand whether the outbreak is accelerating or whether efforts to flatten the curve are working. So if it's a big increase over several days, maybe the outbreak is accelerating. If the increases seem to be slowing down, maybe we're flattening the curve and infections are slowing. But the state also provides this data on a county-by-county basis, so we can drill a little bit deeper, too, and look at the dynamics of outbreaks in individual counties and, at some level, communities. But, yeah, we're also interested, as state health officials are interested in, and a lot of people everywhere are interested in, the number of cases there are in relation to the number of tests that are conducted. And we're especially interested in this as testing expands, because you listeners may have wondered, as we expand testing in the state, we're likely to find more cases, right? Well, that's true, but it's a little bit more complicated than that.
Right, because at the outset, when there were limited numbers of tests and limited capacity to process those tests, we were testing, and it made sense. People who we knew had some kind of exposure or who had symptoms that really matched COVID-19, so those would be the most likely people to test positive. And now as we test more people, that part of the story is going to change, right?
Exactly. I talked to an epidemiologist who described this whole issue kind of in terms of supply and demand and resources. And he said that at the beginning of an outbreak, Wisconsin, like pretty much everywhere in the United States, was dealing with really limited resources in terms of testing. So therefore, state health officials and healthcare providers had to be efficient in doling out those resources. So they did so by limiting who could be tested, as you said, to those kind of really high-risk individuals, or people who are hospitalized with serious symptoms, or others who maybe had come in contact with someone with a known infection. But as those resources have developed, as the state has ramped up its capacity to provide testing, The number of people who are able to get tested has really broadened quite significantly, from those who are hospitalized with serious illness to now in a number of counties, and it's expanding around the state. You can go to a drive-through testing clinic with any type of symptom, whether it's mild or severe, and get tested for COVID-19.
So where are we now when it comes to the number of tests? I know not quite where the state government wants to be, but have we seen a pretty significant increase in the number of tests out there?
We have, yeah. I'm looking at the data right now, and for a while, through most of April, the state was providing results for anywhere between 1,000 to maybe 2,500 tests, give or take several hundred. And just today, the state released results for more than 4,000 tests, which is actually the highest number of test results we've gotten on any given day. So that capacity really has ramped up a lot. And a key metric, kind of the whole point of this reporting that I've been doing, is as testing increases, state health officials are hopeful that the proportion of tests that come back positive, that's what's known as the test positivity rate, goes down, because that could indicate that the state is getting a better handle on the outbreak. Whereas before, when resources were super limited, they might expect to find that the proportion of tests that were coming back positive was much higher, which it was. It wasn't significantly higher than it is now or has been lately, but it definitely was higher earlier in the outbreak when testing was limited to the sicker and more high-risk individuals.
Talking to Will Cushman, associate editor of WisContext, about his new reporting on COVID-19 testing here in Wisconsin, trends, and what the numbers mean and why sometimes it might be more complicated than the raw numbers might look in the first place. Will, let's pick up on what you were just talking about there, those trends. Really, in the scope of things, we haven't been at this that long a time. That said, are we seeing significant trends on that test positivity rate, the number of tests that come back positive relevant to the number of tests we actually do?
You're right, Rob. We haven't been tracking this for very long. And what I can tell you is that the trends so far don't seem to be super indicative of where the outbreak may be going in Wisconsin. The test positivity rate in the state has hovered. It fluctuates daily based on the different test results that are coming in, but it's generally hovered around 10% lately, which is actually a target that the White House has set for states when they're thinking about kind of easing some public health orders like the Safer at Home order in Wisconsin. But state health officials want to see that test positivity rate go down even more, and they want to see it go down over a two-week period. Now, that doesn't have to be 14 consecutive days of declines in the test positivity rate, but they want to see a general trend over 2 weeks. And right now, they're seeing a general trend with a slight increase in that rate, or at least that's what they were seeing a day or two ago. So it seems that we're going to be waiting a little bit longer to see if that trajectory starts going down.
As you mentioned, Will, you talked to some epidemiologists, and we have talked to them on this show as well. It sounds like a difficult task for them, taking this ever-changing landscape where they're getting differing amounts of data and then trying to figure out how to make sense of it to spot these trends. Easier said than done, it sounds like.
Yeah, definitely easier said than done, for sure. I talked to a few epidemiologists who are involved in advising the response of city and county officials in Milwaukee, and they said that they have like an army of biostatisticians and epidemiologists crunching numbers to try to help inform the public health decisions being made there in Milwaukee County. And I know it's the same thing going on at the state as well as with a number of other local health departments. But yeah, there's really a lot of data to get through, and it's quite nuanced. And it's even like these trends that we're seeing can be different depending on the scope of the geographic area that you look at, which makes sense. So the statewide trends might be different than the trends in any given locality. For instance, today I just did a little bit of number crunching myself, and I found that the test positivity rates in a few different communities, large communities with fairly significant outbreaks so far in the state, were wildly different today. So that's the number of tests that came back positive as a proportion of the total number of tests. For instance, in Brown County, where there's been that large outbreak ongoing at meatpacking plants and elsewhere in the community, the number of tests that came back positive today in Brown County was 25%. So that's quite high, and that's worrying. Whereas in Milwaukee, it's a little bit lower. It was at 18.9%. And then in Dane County, where there's really been a slowdown in new cases, the test positivity rate today was 0.6%. So that, I think, gives you a good sense of how the outbreak is so varying around the state right now.
Will, as we wrap up, I know you are always hustling to try to get a handle on this story. What do you have your eye on next?
I am really interested in contact tracing. I think a lot of people are going to be really interested in that as Wisconsin starts to ease some public health restrictions over the coming weeks and months. Contact tracing is going to become really, really important. So I want to know how Wisconsin's going to go about doing that.
Are we seeing much effort toward that? I know I've seen stats like trying to hire 1,000 contact tracers or something like that. Do you know what efforts are in the works?
Yeah, I know that they're trying to hire, as you said, 1,000 contact tracers. That's going to be, I know they're hiring, they're taking applications from anywhere. My understanding is that there may be some state employees who are also reassigned to do contact tracing for a while. And I'm also really interested in potential data-driven approaches to contact tracing and whether the state might get involved in any types of opt-in location tracking apps that can help with contact tracing. That'll be really interesting.
Will, thanks a lot for joining us again.
Thank you, Rob.
Will Cushman is the associate editor of WisContext. His latest piece looks at the latest testing data and what it shows us about the spread of COVID-19 in Wisconsin. You can find that report and a lot more at wiscontext.org. Coming up after the news, senators are back in Washington this week. We'll find out what's on their to-do list and how lawmakers are trying to stay safe. That's part of our weekly look at the latest news in national politics. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we'll find out how some parts of northwestern Wisconsin are getting access to testing for the coronavirus with help from the National Guard. First, we take a look at the week in Washington. President Trump says the White House coronavirus task force will continue a day after saying it was winding down. And the U.S. Senate is back in session this week, taking precautions amid the pandemic and dealing with things like confirmation hearings. Legislation related to COVID-19 isn't high on the agenda, and that has some senators criticizing Majority Leader Mitch McConnell. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you want to see Congress working on right now? If another emergency relief bill related to coronavirus comes together, what do you want to see in it? Are there things that could help you in your job or your health? What questions do you have about what lawmakers are up to this week? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Marianne Levine is a reporter for Politico covering the U.S. Senate. Marianne, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Well, before, Marianne, we get into what they're doing in the Senate, let's talk a little bit about how they're doing it. These are different times for convening a legislative body. What kind of measures are we seeing senators take?
It's a complete completely different environment from when the Senate was in session just about 6 weeks ago. Senators have definitely changed their practices in response to the coronavirus. We can see almost everyone wearing masks when they walk around the Hill. Senate Republicans are still maintaining their in-person lunch, but if they're taking certain precautions, like having three people per dining room table. And so we're seeing a real change in the rhythm of the Senate, and it feels much quieter. There's not as many staff members around, and overall, people are trying really hard to keep their distance from each other and to wear masks and protect themselves from potential exposure to the virus.
We sometimes hear about people being recognized on the Senate floor. I guess there's some trouble with senators being literally recognized when they go up to cast a vote. What kind of things have we seen senators doing to indicate that, yeah, it is me?
It's been funny. Some senators, Senator Kamala Harris, took off her mask to show her face. Kyrsten Sinema, Democrat from Arizona, had purple hair, or lavender hair, I guess I should probably describe it, on Monday. It looked like it was a wig, and she pointed to her hair as she was casting a vote. So sometimes the senators will take off their masks briefly, especially if they're giving or if they're doing a press conference. But for the most part, a lot of them, the vast majority of them have been wearing masks with very few exceptions.
Now, a lot of Congress falls within a higher risk demographic for COVID-19 for age reasons, among others. I understand a federal department, the Department of Health and Human Services, had offered a bunch of rapid tests, 1,000 of them for lawmakers. Nancy Pelosi and Mitch McConnell agreed together that they would decline those tests. Why is that?
Yes, it's one of the rare instances where McConnell and Pelosi agree on something. But the reason why they declined the administration's offer for significantly more testing is they don't want Congress or members of Congress to look like they have special privileges. They recognize that there's a shortage in testing right now in the country, and they're saying that rapid tests, the types of tests where you can get results within minutes, should really go to frontline workers. And so that's their argument. But we're starting to see some criticism, at least among Senate Republicans, of that decision and calls for the Senate to potentially have rapid testing right now. So it's hard to know how long that will last. But as of now, it seems like McConnell and Pelosi are very much in lockstep and saying, hey, we don't want it to look like the Senate has preferential treatment over the American people.
We're talking to Marianne Levine from Politico. It's our weekly look at the latest news in national politics. All right, getting into what the Senate is doing, looking at, first of all, something that they're not doing a lot of, COVID-19 related measures. There have been a bunch passed already, a lot of spending. That doesn't seem to be on the front burner, does it?
Not for a spending package. Different committee hearings are holding meetings about the coronavirus response. But overall, in terms of whether or not the Senate passes another $1 trillion package, that seems to be on pause right now. The House is moving forward, and we're expecting the House to potentially pass another rescue package as early as next week. But the Senate Republicans are saying, let's wait and see how the previous legislation is working before we jump on another large rescue package. So I don't think that we're going to see a huge spending bill from the Senate anytime soon when it comes to coronavirus.
Democratic Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer isn't wild about that. Let's give a listen to him speaking yesterday.
There is no COVID action scheduled this whole week. Leader McConnell brought us back to deal with ideological issues, to appeal to, I guess, some hard right base, but to ignore the huge crisis that the American people are facing.
So what is on the agenda for senators?
So among the agenda items for the senators this week are confirming judicial and executive branch nominees. So yesterday there was a hearing for John Ratcliffe, who has been nominated to become Director of National Intelligence. Republicans say that confirming him is a top national security priority right now. And so that was on the agenda this week. Another big agenda item was the confirmation hearing for Justin Walker. He was was recently nominated to the D.C. Court of Appeals, which is considered to be the second most powerful court in the country. He's considered a McConnell protege, former intern for McConnell. He's from Kentucky. And he had his confirmation hearing today in the Senate Judiciary Committee.
Let's look at each of those in turn, because there's some controversy about both of them. Republican Representative John Ratcliffe, you mentioned, from Texas, nominated to direct the national intelligence operations here in the U.S. He had been floated in the past. He pulled his name out, though, the last time he was nominated. I seem to remember some kind of a frosty reception, even from some key Republican senators. Is there anything different this time around?
Yeah, it's looking quite different. Senator Susan Collins, who was viewed as a potential swing vote on Ratcliffe, has suggested that she will support his nomination. Ratcliffe originally came under fire for embellishing aspects of his resume during his time as U.S. attorney in Texas. But it seems like the second round, he's had less scrutiny from Senate Republicans, and it looks like he's essentially set to be confirmed.
And then Justin Walker, this appeals court nominee, again, people raising concerns there. But is there, given that Republicans control the Senate, is it pretty likely he'll be confirmed as well?
Yes, it's almost a guarantee that he will be confirmed. He was confirmed in October in for the district court position that he currently holds. He's currently a federal judge for the Western District of Kentucky. And right now there are absolutely no signs of any Republican dissension against his nomination. So I think it's a safe bet to say that he will be confirmed.
So is there talk of anything else going on in the Senate on their list of non-COVID to-do items?
There's discussion about whether or not we're going to potentially have a vote on war powers this week or early next week. As you might recall, the Senate voted earlier this year to require President Trump to seek permission, essentially, from Congress, should he want to attack Iran. The Senate passed that resolution earlier this year. The House passed it as well. It's now sent to the president's desk, and we're all expecting a veto. We're not sure when that veto is going to happen, but I think it's expected in the next day or so. So that's another non-coronavirus-related agenda item that we can also expect the Senate to take on.
Is that something, if that's vetoed as expected, are the votes in favor of it enough to override veto?
No, there are not enough votes to override the veto. You need a two-thirds majority in the Senate to override the veto. And while the resolution is bipartisan and had enough Republican support to pass, there's not enough to clear that threshold for a veto override.
We're talking to Marianne Levine, congressional reporter for Politico, and we're looking at some of the latest news in national politics. You can join in at 800-642-1234 as we hear the Senate is in session. What do you think Congress should be working on this week and in the weeks to come? Do you think there need to be more efforts when it comes to coronavirus relief? If so, what kind of things would you like to see? More efforts to help small businesses, for example. There's been talk of more direct payments to American citizens along the lines of the ones that are still coming out right about now from the IRS. Does there need to be more of that? Do you think that Dr. Anthony Fauci testifying in the Senate next week is a good idea? Should he have been able to testify before the House? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our weekly look at the latest news in national politics. Marianne Levine is with us from Politico. We're talking about what lawmakers are working on this week in the nation's capital. Still time for you to join in at 800-642-1234. Should Congress pass and the president sign more relief efforts when it comes to COVID-19 and the impact it's had on the economy? What would help the country? What would help the economy? And what would help you? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Staying with the topic of potential ideas in coronavirus relief, you mentioned, Marianne, that the House was considering doing something beyond what's already been done. What kind of ideas are bouncing around on that side of Congress?
The House is looking at about a $1 trillion package, and a lot of the ideas floating around have to do with ensuring that state governments have enough money to survive. A lot of the state governments have been hit hard by the coronavirus pandemic, and so members of the House are saying that aid to state and local governments is a key component of any next phase in coronavirus funding.
And that's been controversial, right? Some in Congress and the president have not always been warm to that idea.
That's correct. Senate Republicans have voiced concern that they are, quote unquote, bailing out blue states, saying that they shouldn't be responsible for funding states that have, quote unquote, mismanaged their budgets. That's what the Senate Republican argument has been against providing more money. And they're also warning against increasing the deficit and saying, hey, let's take a pause on the Senate spending and look at how the previous packages are working. Now, one red line that Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell has drawn on any negotiation is he's saying he wants liability protections. And I think that's going to be a really big issue in the weeks to come. He's basically saying that employers are very prone to lawsuits right now, and that he wants to include measures in there to prevent unnecessary coronavirus-related lawsuits. So that's going to be something up for debate and a key negotiating principle as the House and Senate decide how they want to move forward in future coronavirus-related packages.
And the president had floated ideas of tax cuts, payroll tax cuts, among other things. Is that something that people in the Senate in particular are warming up to?
No, not at all. Senate Republicans yesterday were pretty clear that this is not, they don't view the payroll tax cut as anything, any sort of red line, as the president has suggested. And they also warned that a payroll tax cut could have negative consequences. So we're not expecting many Senate Republicans to embrace the idea of a payroll tax cut, despite the president's push for one in any future coronavirus package.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Owen is with us in Wyawega. Hi, Owen.
Hi, Rob. Thanks for taking my call. Yeah, my concerns are this. Now, we need to look at the national debt. We need to look at the kind of money we're borrowing. We need to figure out how and when we're going to be able to pay that back. Well, I already know that's out of control. Second thing is, we need to put the risk back into business. The business of farming, they've eliminated all the risk. No matter how good your management skills are as a farmer, those don't matter. Your management skills, somebody who knows how to apply for the right grants and subsidies, make you successful now. It's not how well you do in the actual job that you're trying to do. And the same thing goes for the repair business I operate. My competitors are able to buy out money even if they weren't good repair people, and they're able to advertise and become very competitive that way because of the money that's out there that's easy to obtain.
Owen, thanks a lot for the call. You gave us a lot to talk about. First of all, he mentioned how we pay for these things. Are you hearing people, Marianne, in the Senate and in Congress in general, talking about the impact of especially that last big economic relief package on the federal budget?
Yes, Republicans are once again raising concerns about the deficit. That's been a big concern now that Congress has spent trillions of dollars to address the coronavirus pandemic. So there is talk of the deficit. What's interesting is a lot of economists are actually encouraging Congress right now to spend. Even conservative economists are saying Congress should spend money right now to avoid the economic impacts of the job losses that are expected from this crisis. So it's an interesting dynamic we're seeing, but we're definitely hearing from Senate Republicans a bit more about the deficit, which we haven't heard a ton of them talk about since President Trump was elected. So it's an interesting moment right now that we are going back to that conversation about the deficit and the need to potentially rein back spending.
And Owen also mentioned which businesses get relief under various economic recovery actions. And I know there was debate about this going into the last economic recovery package and after, people saying it should be more for smaller businesses, not for bigger ones. Are we seeing recriminations about who was covered under things like the Paycheck Protection Plan?
Yeah, there have been some issues with the Paycheck Protection Program, and Democrats have in the last $484 billion that Congress approved are trying to address some of the complaints about the Paycheck Protection Program, which is the funding program to help small businesses that have been hit hard by the pandemic. Among the complaints was that some of this money was going to chain restaurants. You might have seen that Shake Shack, I believe, returned their loan. And so you're seeing some complaints about some of this money going to big national chains instead of to the small mom-and-pop shops that they're intended to go to. Democrats were also pushing for this money to go more towards underserved communities and geared towards that population. So we're seeing some trial and error with the Paycheck Protection Program, and it looks like lawmakers are trying to adjust and make changes as this proceeds.
Talking to Marianne Levine from Politico, looking at some of the latest news in Congress. Back to your calls now. Gary is with us in Iron River. Gary, hi.
Hi, good afternoon, folks. Say a couple quick things. One, this whole fund the state issue is a complex can of worms. We have states like Wisconsin, who's rebuilt a decent rainy day fund and well has a well-designed and fully funded pension. And then we have states like Illinois with virtually no rainy day fund and a horribly underfunded pension. So we can't cover all of the costs for every state and penalize those of us living in states who have managed things fairly well, since all the money has got to come from the taxpayers eventually, or the taxpayers' kids.
And Gary, and thanks a lot for the call. And Marianne, Gary is hitting on a point in an argument mm-hmm. that's brought in Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, the president, governors of various states. This is a hot issue, kind of a moral hazard of bailing out the states here.
Yeah, there's definitely a lot of discussion around that. Senate Republicans are, Rick Scott, for example, from Florida, has taken on this issue a lot and has attacked Andrew Cuomo, governor of New York, for New York spending. He and several other senators sent a letter recently to President Trump saying, let's make sure that there's guardrails on state and local spending. We don't want to be bailing out states like Illinois and who are struggling with their pension systems. And so there is that concern among the Senate Republicans about state and local money that's being spent without any guardrails. Now Democrats would obviously disagree with that idea and say that the state and local governments are very much in need and hit quite hard by this pandemic, and that they're going to need funds to recover, to save jobs and ensure that that the trains keep moving and run on time.
Thanks a lot for the call. I mentioned the Coronavirus Relief Task Force off, apparently, and then back on. I wanted to talk about a key member of that task force, Dr. Anthony Fauci. He was called by both the House and Senate committees to testify. Last I saw, there was one no and one yes there. What's in the cards?
That's right. We're expecting Dr. Anthony Fauci to testify before the Senate next week to talk about the administration's response to the coronavirus. The House also requested that Fauci appear, but the Trump administration blocked him from coming to a House committee hearing that was supposed to be on the issue of coronavirus testing. Trump obviously has a lot of resentment towards House Democrats, particularly over the impeachment proceedings, it seems. And so he said, I believe on Tuesday, that the Fauci interview would be a set, or that the Fauci's appearance would be a setup, and that he described the House as a bunch of Trump haters. So basically the administration is saying that they don't want Fauci appearing before the House, but he is expected to appear before the Senate, and that is going to definitely be a must-watch hearing for members and for the public.
Marianne, in our last minute or so, what are you watching for next in Congress?
Next in Congress, we're watching to see what we're watching to see what happens with war powers, which is expected soon. And we're definitely going to be going to the Fauci hearing next week, and we'll be looking at all the potential developments with a phase four package. One thing to note is that the Paycheck Protection Program, which has wide bipartisan support, is expected to run out of money soon again. And so it'll be interesting to see how Congress decides to respond to that and whether or not that might force the Senate to act more quickly than Republicans right now are suggesting.
Marianne, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Marianne Levine is a reporter for Politico covering the U.S. Senate. She joined us today for a look at the latest news in national politics, our weekly look at the week in Washington. You can still let us know what you think about the Senate being back in session this week. Do you want senators to be working on another coronavirus economic relief package? If so, what do you want to see in it? Business support, money for health care, support for state and local governments, something else? And what would make a difference in your life and your job? Let us know what you want Congress to be up to now. You can email ideas@WPR.org, or as always, you can reach us on Twitter. Tweet us @CentralTimeWPR. Let us know what you think about this week in Washington. In about a half an hour, we'll take a look at the skies with some advice on star and planet watching for the coming months here in Wisconsin. But all that stuff is way out there in space. That's a long ways away, so maybe you want to bring some of it in for a closer look. Well, good news, you are in luck, if you have $2.5 million to spend. The auction house Christie's posted an item for sale last week, a moon rock weighing 29 pounds. How'd the astronauts get such a heavy rock down to Earth? They didn't. As reported by Smithsonian Magazine, this moon rock is a lunar meteorite. That's a chunk of the moon that was dislodged by some kind of impact, came down on the Sahara Desert, and it was found a couple years ago. 29 pounds may not sound like much, but we humans have only tracked down about 1,500 pounds of lunar meteorites total, and some people have really been looking. So a big chunk like this is a pretty rare find. It's being sold in a private sale through the auction house, but not as an auction, just a straight-up price tag. I'm not sure whether it's sold yet or not, but if not, $2.5 million is a lot of cash. But there are over 5.8 million people here in Wisconsin. If we each kick in 50 cents, that would cover the price of the meteorite and I think shipping costs too. And then we could just pass it around. Think about it. Get back to me on that. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.